Hold fast, my friends, to the Constitution. Miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. The Constitution of the United States as a miracle. In speaking those words, the 19th century statesman Daniel Webster was giving voice to a view that is still common today. Our guest sees the document not as a miracle, but as a hindrance. Political scientist Terry Moe and his new book, Relic. Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The William Bennett Monroe Professor of Political Science at Stanford, Terry Moe, is also a fellow at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Moe has written extensively on education reform and the presidency, and with his co-author William Howell of the University of Chicago, Dr. Moe has published Relic, How Our Constitution Undermines Effective Government and Why We Need a More Powerful Presidency. Terry Moe, welcome.
Great to be with you.
I want to go through the argument of the book step by step.
Great.
First, let's start with a kind of summary statement. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting from Relic. It is folly to think that what may have worked quite well in that world, that is, a document designed in the 18th century world of the founders, it is folly to think that it will also work well in ours. Now, obvious point, we live with all kinds of pre-modern institutions. Democratic assemblies date back 2,500 years. English common law remains the foundation of a great deal of American law, that's medieval. Why is it folly to suppose that an 18th century document will work in the 21st century?
Well, look at it. You know, the founders designed a government for a tiny agrarian society in 1789. There were 4 million people in that society. 700,000 of them were slaves. Of the free people, 95% were farmers. It was a very simple society. Government wasn't expected to do much, and they designed a government that couldn't do much. A government of separation of powers with a very parochial Congress at its lawmaking center. And that kind of government may have been fine for the late 1700s. But as society became much more modern, industrialized, urbanized, and generated a whole range of very serious problems, you know, from monopoly to child labor to pollution to disease and all kinds of issues that people thought government needed to do something about, government was simply incapable of acting. They had created a government for their times, but the kind of government, the structure of government that they created, was simply ill-suited to take effective action in modern times. That's the real problem. Now, we can't blame the founders for that. I mean, how could they have foreseen any of this? They couldn't have. They knew they couldn't. And Jefferson and others fully expected that the Constitution represented an experiment in government and that future generations would adapt it and adjust it to suit the needs of a changing society. But that didn't happen. And so basically we're stuck with this structure that they gave us 225 years ago.
Well, you say it didn't happen, but on your own argument, certain things did happen. So you make the point, of course, there's slavery, we get the 14th Amendment, the Constitution is changed,
right.
Women are denied the vote, we get the 19th Amendment, women are given the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make a great deal of the progressive movement.
Yes.
A century ago. Tell us why that matters. Tell us why you view it as having been necessary and what it accomplished, the progressive movement.
Yeah. Okay, so the bigger point is that the basic structure of government hasn't changed. And has been passed down over the last 225 years, and we're prisoners of that past. The progressive movement is the most powerful movement for governmental reform that we've ever had in this country. The best way to understand it is that the founders designed a government for a tiny agrarian society, mm-hmm. and society then didn't stay that way. Society changed. And it really changed in the late 1800s and early 1900s. That's when America really industrialized. By
post-Civil War, really, is the the industrialization explosion of immigration, so the population explodes. Right.
Yeah, it's immigration, urbanization, industrialization. Meantime, the population in 1900 is about 15 times what it was in 1790. The country goes all the way to the Pacific Ocean. The nation is huge, right? And meantime, industrialization is generating, along with urbanization, all these problems, you know, like unregulated drugs and predatory railroad behavior, you know, and tainted meat that makes people sick, and monopolies, and all sorts of things that are creating serious problems for society that people want government to do something about, right? These are new problems of a modern society. Yet they're...
Terry, within that narrative, can I just ask you to pause? Do you give the document, the structure, the constitutional arrangements, credit for being flexible and enduring enough to permit this enormous growth? It is under... we come to the problems in a moment, but I'm wondering if you give it sort of partial credit. If you're a professor, do you give it partial credit for permitting the country to grow 15 times in population, to become industrial? Isn't that an impressive achievement for an 18th century document?
Well, yeah, we would give it partial credit, and we do. But basically, you know, this nation has been blessed with tremendous natural resources and with an entrepreneurial citizen body throughout the country that has... use those resources very productively. And to a large extent, what the government did, since it was incapable of doing much, was get out of the way and let the private sector really boom, right? Well, I think that's fine within limits. But then when you have all the problems that go along with urbanization and industrialization, you know, like child labor, say, or like monopoly, then that's when the government has to step in and take action when maybe 50 years earlier didn't need to take action on those things.
Okay, so you get the leader of the progressive movement is Woodrow Wilson, and I'm quoting him as you quote him in Relic. Mm-hmm. Woodrow Wilson, the president is at liberty, both in law and conscience, to be as big a man as he can. That, on your account in Relic, that's the central point of the progressive movement, a critique of congressional behavior or arrangements, and an expansion of the powers, or at least of the comportment of the presidency, correct?
Well, let me put it in somewhat different words.
Go.
What the progressives recognized at the time was that here they had this profoundly different society that was bursting at the seams and creating all sorts of problems that weren't getting dealt with, and they were trapped in a governmental system that was designed more than 100 years earlier, that didn't work, and that had Congress at its lawmaking center. Here, this Congress is totally parochial, rooted in districts and states, wide open to special interest pressures, and totally corrupt to boot. And what, Congress is going to solve these problems? I don't think so, right? So the progressives came along and said, we want good government. Okay, how are you going to get it? Well, they did a number of things, including trying to get rid of spoils, trying to eliminate corruption, and so on. But more generally, structurally, what they did was to try to shift power away from Congress and the party machines by creating an administrative state, a bureaucracy, that was rooted in expertise and merit, which any advanced nation needs to have if policies are going to be carried out effectively.
So civil service reform is a big part
of
it.
Yes, it's a big part of it. And having a presidency that is... the real leadership of the country in a separation of power system where presidents can't actually pass laws, right? Congress has to pass the laws, but presidents can take the lead and be a more dynamic focus for the energy of the nation in solving social problems. And Teddy Roosevelt was the real symbolic force here of progressivism.
He comes before Woodrow Wilson.
And then Woodrow Wilson follows up.
Right.
And it's not an accident that both Roosevelt and Wilson said, hey, you know, we need to take the lead and we will do whatever we need to do, you know, within the constraints of the law. And this was a fundamental shift in the concept of what the presidency was, what the role of the president was within the American political system. And ever since then, all modern presidents have basically adopted this concept of what the presidency is all about, Republicans and Democrats alike.
Okay, so let me see if I can sum up the argument to about a century ago. 18th century, you get a document that I get the feeling you wouldn't have written it that way even in, to start with, but government was so small and so little was expected of it that it worked. It was okay. Then you get the adjustment of the progressive movement. It takes place within the structure, the existing structure of the Constitution, but you get Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson saying, within this structure,
yes,
we need to rebalance power. We need a more vigorous, more assertive presidency. Woodrow Wilson, as I recall, there's civil service reform. He's the first president who begins giving State of the Union addresses in person. He is more assertive in every way in sending up legislation, directing Congress, attempting to direct Congress. And your argument is that's a fix or a workaround that's okay for that day as well, correct? The progressive movement achieves a great deal of what needed to be done by then, but at that time?
Yeah, I think they found themselves prisoners of the past, and they needed a government that could be more effective. They had a government that was totally ineffective. And so they needed to do what they could do. And what they did was they built up the bureaucracy, created for the first time, you know, a civil service-based bureaucracy that could actually do things, right, carry out policy, and a more powerful presidency. And from that point on, we have had what some people call a presidentially led bureaucratic government. And that's basically the nature of modern American government. Now, the problem is that it didn't do away with the fundamental problem, which is...
Right, now I want to get... So progressives, and now fill us in with what's still wrong, so to speak.
Still have the same basic structure of government, which is Congress makes the laws.
I'm reading...
Right, presidents don't make the laws, Congress makes the laws.
Under the Constitution, Congress is granted the authority to make the laws, and the fact that it makes them badly, and indeed is wired to make them badly, fatally undermines the ability of American government to meet the challenges of modern society, close quote. Wired to make them badly.
Yeah.
Bring out that part of the argument, Terry.
Well, it's simple, but profound. It goes back to the Constitution's design of the Constitution, of Congress, which ensures that members of Congress are elected from districts and from states, and are going to be responsive to the constituencies and special interests of those districts and states, and are going to be concerned about getting reelected. And that makes them parochial, and it makes it almost impossible for them as a two-house collective institution to really do what's right for the national interest. They're not acting in the national interest. They're acting in hundreds of different special interests, and Congress is just wide open to special interests. Always has been, it still is, right? Congress is just not capable of effectively pursuing the national interest, and that is right at the heart of the problem. It goes back to the Constitution, it's still there, and nothing has changed that.
And so you've got 435 members of the House. I mean, it's one thing to say that each individual member of the House will be above all sensitive to the interests of his own district. But it's another thing to say that the counterbalancing, the deal making that has to go on, the log rolling, the compromises and so forth to produce any legislation at all, it's another thing to say that Congress as a whole is incapable of pursuing the national interest. The founders' idea, so how do you, the founders' idea is wrong in principle, that all of these counterbalancing, the founders set it up so that the only way to get legislation through would be a protracted series of process of compromise. And your argument is that even that doesn't work. Congress as a whole can't function.
Well, the first argument is that they were operating in 1789. And they never thought Congress would be doing the kinds of things that is doing today. That the vast array of problems, you know, of poverty, of inequality, of immigration, of infrastructure, of terrorism, of disruptive technology, of globalization, all these things would be dumped on Congress. People would say, do something. And there Congress is. It's just pathetic. You know, it's incapable of taking effective action. Right? They didn't see that back in 1789. How could they? Right? They're living in a completely different world. Right? It's up to us to do something. They expected that we would. We didn't, right? So we're left with an ancient constitution that never anticipated any of this.
Okay. You use a couple of specific examples in Relic of how Congress has failed to act. Immigration. I'm quoting Relic. 11 million people, that's the number of people, the estimate, who are in the country illegally.
Yeah.
11 million people cannot be deported without massive costs, social unrest, and conflict. But nor can these undocumented people be ignored. Something needs to be done, maybe a path to citizenship, maybe something else, but something, close quote.
Mm-hmm.
And that, on the very face of it, shows congressional ineptitude, the immigration
Absolutely.
Problem. It does.
Yeah, I mean, we've basically been in the midst of an immigration total breakdown for going on decades.
Okay,
right?
So let me push a little bit.
And Congress has been incapable of resolving this, even though people in both parties say it needs to get resolved somehow.
But the laws are on the books. It's the chief executive of both parties that has failed to enforce the law at the border. 4 million or so of the people who are in the country illegally have simply failed to comply with their visa requirements. The chief executive has at no point needed congressional approval to solve that problem. It's a failure of the chief executive to enforce laws that are already on the books. Shouldn't we think twice before giving more power to a chief executive who's done so much, which has done so much, not in any individual? You're quite right, it's been 30 years now. But shouldn't we think twice about giving more power to a chief executive that has done so much to permit the problem to arise in the first place? Isn't that a problem for your argument?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that this is an executive problem. It's a problem that goes back.
It's a chief executive that failed to enforce the laws.
I think that what you have is a problem that is insoluble without new legislation. Right? We have 11 million people here who are undocumented.
But you also have a problem that would never have arisen if the chief executives had enforced the laws that were already on the books.
I think that for a variety of very practical and also very political reasons, they didn't get enforced.
Correct.
Right? Yes, they didn't get enforced.
Correct.
But it's not
the fault of the chief executive.
These people are not sitting there focusing just on keeping people out of this country, right? The Democrats, for instance, like having immigrants in this country, right? Because if they ever get citizenship, they're going to vote Democrat.
Right.
The Republicans have many constituents, farm constituents, right? Like in California, they want these workers. They like those immigrants, right? So they also have, on the social side of their party, people who don't like the immigrants, right? And want to keep them out. So when it comes to enforcing the passed law, there's been no consensus on how to do that. The parties are both divided on that. Right, so the result is we wind up over time with a policy that doesn't make any sense, that doesn't get enforced, and you know, people on both sides sit back and say, all right, look, this is not working. Plus, we have all these people here who are undocumented. The laws are a joke because they're being ignored.
By the chief executive.
They're being ignored by everybody.
Basically. But how would giving more power to the chief executive solve the problem? That's the question. Let's put it that way.
Let's not use power in a generic way, right? What we're saying mm-hmm. is, in the end, on legislation only, we would shift power in the president's direction. And the purpose of that is to get better legislation. So I think what a lot of people think of when they hear, oh, you want to give the president more power, is unilateral power. Right, so that like Obama's 2014 executive order on immigration, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about giving the president additional power in the lawmaking process.
Right.
Okay, so then what the president would do is he would make a proposal to Congress, and if there were fast-track authority, we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
A little bit, but
yeah,
that's all right.
Then,
we'll come back.
Then Congress would have to vote up or down. Now, if you look at immigration in the past, right, because George W. Bush was trying to solve this thing too, right? And twice he had bills before Congress that went down on a Senate filibuster, right? The votes were there. It's just that because Congress has these arcane rules, undemocratic rules, these things went down. There were bipartisan majorities for immigration reform. If the president had had fast-track authority and Congress had to vote up or down on a majoritarian basis within 90 days or whatever, he would have voted yes, and it would have passed, and we would have had immigration reform. Obama then also proposed immigration reform in 2013, a legislative solution, just like Bush was seeking. In his case, Boehner, Speaker Boehner in the House, there was bipartisan support in the House. He refused to bring it up for a vote, so it never got voted on. So it went down. Okay, that's when Obama then issued his executive order, right? Mm-hmm. So this is really fundamentally a legislative problem. It can be solved legislatively with Congress involved, because Congress has to agree to every piece of legislation that comes through. So we're only shifting power in the direction of the president so that he can participate more effectively in the legislative process, not to give him unilateral powers.
Let me go to one other example that you use in RELIC, agriculture. You describe that as part of Newt Gingrich's contract with America, under which the Republicans recapture the House of Representatives in the election of 1994 for the first time in 40 years, Republicans eliminated most federal subsidies to agriculture. Quite a breathtaking achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And
if temporary.
But temporary. And within just a few years, they had backtracked. I'm quoting RELIC again. By 2000, literally half of all farm income was coming from taxpayers. And in 2002, Congress reinstated the old crop subsidies, but at higher levels, close quote. And with a stronger president, the backsliding would never have happened? Let me dump my whole question on the table so you can deal with it all at once. Here's what comes to my mind immediately when we say Congress, they managed to eliminate the agriculture subsidies, and then they give them right back. And Terry's argument is we need a stronger presidency. And then little Robinson thinks, wait a minute. In Japan and every country in Western Europe, they have much stronger executives than we have. The presidency of the French under the Fifth Republic is very little short of a monarchy. The French president gets to do what he wants to do. He moves legislation through. And every one of those countries provides huge subsidies to agriculture. To be a rice farmer in Japan is to be one of the most subsidized people on the planet. Why is that not a problem for your argument?
I think you have to evaluate the incentives of the players in context, in their own institutional context. All the systems that you refer to are parliamentary systems. Mm-hmm. The incentives there are very different. And we're not proposing a parliamentary system here. I think it's important not to get off on that kind of track where there are so many variables that come into play that it can quickly become confusing. We should focus here on the American president, what his incentives are in the United States, in our structure of government. Now, in this case, what we would say is that, look, in general, presidents are concerned, unlike Congress, with national constituencies, with solving national problems in effective ways, and, unlike members of Congress, they're totally driven by their legacies, their historical legacies. They all want to be great. They all want to be regarded as great leaders. And the way you get to be regarded as a great leader is to achieve things, to take on important social issues and problems, to solve them with policies that work long term. That's what really drives presidents. Now, you might disagree with what a particular president wants to do, right, if he's of the other party, right? Mm-hmm. But the drive is to solve problems in an effective way. This is not what drives Congress, but it is what drives presidents. So what I would say in this case, when it comes to the agricultural case, it's very hard to find an economist who thinks that our system of farm subsidies makes any sense at all. Yeah. It is a throwback to a bygone era, to the 1930s and 40s, right? Economists basically say, look, this is inefficient. It's bad for
Got
the country.
That. Got that.
Presidents in general tend to favor what economists favor when it comes to efficiency for the nation, because it's good for the whole nation. Presidents would tend to be opposed to this kind of thing. This is typical congressional legislation.
I'd feel better if you could find one strong executive somewhere in the world who was doing something rational with regard to agriculture and subsidies. I'm sure economists think that the subsidies in France, for example, make no economic sense. They're totally irrational. And yet one French president after another, these are men with immense power, capitulate to the farmers again and again and again.
Okay. I think that in general, the farming sector is quite powerful in Europe and also in Japan. But you have to ask, okay, how is power structured in those systems and how does it shape the incentives of politicians? Okay, and sitting here right now, we, A, are not prepared to talk about that and bring it to bear on what's happening in the United States. And if we do that, it's going to just make everything way too complicated. We should focus on the way things are in this country and the president's incentives.
One other question now. You said Congress, the incentives for Congress are parochial. The president thinks of in terms of the national good. Okay. Easy to grasp. How is it that Newt Gingrich pulled off that contract with America? Again, agree with it or not, but he came up with, it was 10 points, I think, wasn't it? 10 points, and he ran a national campaign mm-hmm. for the House of Representatives, which was successful. I'm just wondering how it affects, I'm not saying that refutes your argument because it's happened once in recent times, mm-hmm. but what were the incentives? How did that happen? How did Congress behave the way I think Terry Moe and William Howell would like to
well,
see
how do you
behave
think it behaved?
It acted in the national interest.
By doing what? They didn't achieve the contract with America.
Oh, it achieved quite a few points in the contract.
They got
with America.
Some of it. They got some of it.
You yourself argue that that it was a remarkable achievement to cut back the federal subsidies to agriculture. They got that.
Yeah, I know, but that was later gutted by Congress itself.
Right. But right. Why did they one time, why were they able to run on
how
a national
how to go with term agenda? Limits.
They didn't get term. Why were they able to run on a national agenda in 1994? And does that affect your argument?
No. I think that one of the things that's happened during the modern era is that nationalizing forces have become more important. And it's due in part to polarization. The simple fact that you have, you know, Republican conservatives fairly homogeneous, liberal Democrats fairly homogeneous, they tend to vote together, doesn't mean that they're all thinking about what's in the national good. These people, when push comes to shove, are always thinking about what's happening locally, what's happening in their states and their districts. And if you look at the legislation that gets passed, there are all sorts of provisions in there for them. Right, to make them happy. Oh, there's a company here that needs some kind of special break. We'll put that in there for you. Or we'll take this thing out because it hurts, you know, an oil company in your district, right? And before you know it, you get these pieces of legislation that are ridiculous as serious attacks on social problems. They aren't attacks on social problems. They're not intellectually justifiable attacks. That's what Congress does.
The fix. Let's take your proposal. Let's bear in on the proposal and give that some time here. Relic, quote, mm-hmm. The most promising way to move our governmental system in the right direction is by amplifying the powers of the presidency. Presidents should be granted enhanced agenda-setting powers to propose bills to Congress, which Congress should then be required to vote on without amendment on a strictly majoritarian basis within a fixed period of time. This is the way fast-track authority currently works in the realm of international trade, close quote. Okay, let's go through all that. First of all, explain fast-track authority. What is it?
Well, you just did, and you did a great job of it.
By reading, right? Reading your book.
Yeah, right. So it was first adopted in 1974 under Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. And it was a recognition by Congress that if they didn't do something like that, didn't allow for fast track, we would really never have trade agreements. They would never work, right? Because imagine if the president were out trying to negotiate trade agreements with Europe or with any parties, right? Any other nations. And then when he brought an agreement back, sent it to Congress, Congress just picked it apart. Said, oh, we're going to do this, but we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Go back and, you know, then the president, as a bargainer, would lose all credibility with these other countries, and he would have no bargaining authority, right? So that doesn't work. So Congress decided that the only way we're ever going to get anywhere in international trade is by letting the president negotiate these things. He comes up with a package, mm-hmm. and then he presents the proposal to Congress, and Congress has to accept the whole thing without changing it. They can vote no. Or
up
yes,
or down,
up or down.
But no amendments.
No amendments.
Right.
right? None of these special interest provisions. Plus, they can't delay, can't sandbag the thing. They have to vote on it within X number of days. So that's the key to the whole thing, right? And it's a very simple mechanism that gives both the president and Congress a role, and it ensures that if anything is going to become law, both the House and the Senate must vote yes.
Okay, explicate one other bit. You write that Congress would have to vote on a strictly majoritarian basis.
Yes.
Explain that one.
No filibusters.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Senate has to vote 51.
Yeah, up or down.
Up or down, 51 passes, and
yes.
you can't filibuster.
Yes.
The point of a filibuster is it takes 60 votes in the Senate to shut down a filibuster, so it requires a supermajority. That's what you're opposed to there.
Right.
Okay, got it. Now, let's take, so that's the Moe and Howell proposal in Relic. One of your critics, I think it may be one of your severest critics of reading the literature, our colleague here at the Hoover Institution, mm-hmm. Richard Epstein. Richard takes the example of Obamacare, which of course passed Congress without a single Republican vote in either the House or the Senate. So it was as partisan, literally as partisan a vote as it could be. Mm-hmm. All the Democrats, no Republicans in both houses. And then Richard argues that if a president had been responsible for drafting the legislation, that is, give Terry Moe his reform, if that reform had been in place, the president would have drafted the legislation, then the Democrats could have enacted even more partisan legislation, or if the Republicans had a majority, they could have voted it down outright. Now, I quote Richard Epstein, this new proposed system, the reform you advocate, will thus lead to one of two equilibrium positions. Either a partisan president gets all that he wants, or a determined Congress forces us back into the legislative pathologies that are rife today. Close quote. Give Terry Moe his reform, and you get either an imperial presidency or just the same dysfunction we've already got. Over to you.
Well, Richard's just totally wrong on that. You know, I mean, there's a big literature on how agenda control works. How these bargaining situations work. And you don't get these polar outcomes, you know, binary outcomes, this one or the other. You know, it can be outcomes in between. For instance, presidents submit a policy proposal, or they're thinking of submitting a policy proposal to Congress, and they have to look over the distribution of votes in Congress. And they have to think, okay, I want to win, right? And how am I going to get these votes? And so
they start doing the deals
yes.
that you find so offensive in the first place.
That's right.
They start giving guys dams in their districts.
They might.
And a little federal grant for beekeeping.
Except presidents don't like those things.
So you get less of it.
You get less of it. You get a lot less of it. So you're still going to get this horse trading.
You
right?
do not eliminate politics.
No.
You just tidy it up.
That's right.
Okay.
And so you're going to get much more coherent, much better justified attacks on social problems than Congress would come up with. Congress is a disaster. Congress is not formulating effective solutions to national problems. Presidents actually try to do that, right? Now, they're not going to be perfect, right? They're going to have to, you know, corrupt the things that they do in order to sell them to Congress. But they're not going to be as gutted and eviscerated as the kinds of things that Congress passes regularly.
Okay. The conservative quandary. You devote special attention in Relic to the conservative argument for your reform. Let me quote you. Actually, let me take a little time with this. I want to
sure.
quote you, and I want to set up an argument, and then just dump it in your lap and see what you do with
right.
it. So I'm quoting from Relic. Quote, conservatives who favor smaller government, a perfectly legitimate thing to want, thank you very much, Dr. Moe, should ask themselves how successful have Republican presidents been at paring back the American welfare state and achieving a smaller, less wasteful government? Answer, despite occupying the White House about 50% of the time during the entire post-war era, they have not been successful at all. Close quote. True. But, here's the but. Now let me construct my little tiny argument here and then toss it to you.
Sure.
The reform you propose would make the president more powerful in the legislative process,
right.
and that's a two-edged sword. It can be used to shrink the administrative state, or it can be used to expand the administrative state. Is it not the case that conservatives ought to be in favor of a single-edged sword, one that presidents could use but would use overwhelmingly just to cut, to reduce, to shrink. And that could be accomplished pretty simply. Just repeal the Impoundment Control Act of 1974. Richard Nixon impounds funds, Congress gets very angry. It passes a law making it virtually impossible for presidents to impound funds, that is to refuse to spend money that Congress allocates. Repeal that, Congress can go ahead and allocate money, and presidents at that point get to refuse to spend it. It would enormously increase the president's authority in the budget negotiation. If you wanted to, you could also argue that one amendment to the Constitution, a line item veto, it would have the same effect. It would permit presidents to go into bills and veto specific items in bills without having to veto the entire bill. Those two reforms would overwhelmingly have the effect of giving presidents the ability to shrink, to control, to limit the growth of government in the national interest, but would be very hard to use to expand the welfare state. Isn't that what conservatives ought to want?
Probably.
And thank you for your patience, by the way, because that was quite a lot of huffing and puffing.
No,
go ahead.
That's good. This book is not about what's good for Republicans and what's good for Democrats. We don't take a stand on whether the United States should have small government or big government. I think you're right that if you really want small government, you can easily come up with constitutional revisions that would work to your advantage.
They cut in one way.
But we purposely favored a constitutional provision that doesn't favor either side, that basically says that if the people elect a president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, that president is going to have policies that he or she will pursue in a much more effective manner than Congress will. So if the American people want to get the policies that they vote for, if they want to have real accountability in their government and a government that can be effective, this is the way to do it. And it doesn't prejudge whether the Americans should want big government or should want small government, mm-hmm. right? That's up to them. This is a democracy, right? And so, I mean, when Richard Epstein wades in and says, we should have smaller government, okay, he has one vote, you know, fine. He wants smaller government. Good for him. Well, not everybody wants that. This is a democracy, right? So we need to have institutions that work for everybody, right? So if people vote in Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan wants to pare back the welfare state, question is, and he'd been voted in on that basis, can he do that? And the answer is no, he can't do that. Why? Because we have a separation of power system, and Congress is right there at the center, and they are not going to go along with this, and they didn't.
They didn't.
That's right.
I can remember Ed Meese describing to me his shock when he came back from Capitol Hill after talking to the leadership, his first meeting up there. Ed Meese was then counselor to the president. And the first thing they said was, you guys are not eliminating the Department of Education.
Yeah.
That's just boom. That was the first week after Reagan was inaugurated. Okay, a few last questions, Terry. The Constitution provides for two mechanisms for amendments. Either Congress calls for an amendment, which the states then ratify, or the states call for a constitutional convention, which Congress then must, if there are enough votes, Congress must put in place. So you've got two mechanisms. How are you going to get this reform enacted? How are you going to get your amendment enacted?
Well, a couple of things. One, I see, and I think William sees, our first job as being one of trying to understand the nature of the problem. I think the biggest problem facing this country is not, you know, who's going to win the election, you know, and every 4 years people get all wrapped up in that, you know, like it's the number one question. Number one question is, how is this country going to be governed? And the fact is, and has always been, this country is governed very ineffectively, right? And so presidents come into office and they can't do things. Right? They can't actually take effective action. Right? That is the problem. So what are we going to do about that? Right? So the number one problem, I think, is to connect ineffective government to the Constitution and show why that is, and to show why Congress is right at the center of that. Now, it's helpful, I think, to move on from that and say, okay, is there anything that we can do? I personally consider that a second order issue. Maybe I'm just a dyed-in-the-wool academic, right? But I think the more people understand that this is a problem and that it goes back to the Constitution, and that rather than just worshiping the Constitution and the founders, we should actually think empirically, objectively about the Constitution. What effects does it actually have on our governance today? Well, it has some very negative effects. Okay, what can we do about that? All right, so it turns out you want to try to do something about it, it's hard, right? And it's hard because amending the Constitution is hard.
Very hard.
Why is it hard? Well, the founders made it hard. That's another thing where we're prisoners of the past, right? 225 years ago, they did this thing and they said, hey, it's almost impossible to amend the Constitution. Good luck to you guys, right? Okay, well, here we are. So you point out that it's difficult to do. It is difficult to do. So first point, will Congress pass resolutions saying, yeah, you know, we want to have
limit this, our power.
This, yeah, limit our own power.
Undarned likely.
Yeah, right? Unlikely.
Right.
Right? Okay. And will the states then, if we go this second route, agree that we should have constitutional conventions to do this? And I think that's the more likely route. If the argument gets out there and people get convinced that, you know, this is a system that doesn't work, how much longer can we put up with this, you know? So this is the way to do it. And then I think the potential danger of that is if the conventions can't somehow be limited to this issue, and they can be opened up, then I think all of us see that there could be risks in that, right?
So this is, you know all this, the Constitution has been amended 27 times. All 27 times, it's been by an amendment that Congress has called for. The first mechanism has been used. Having the states require Congress to hold a constitutional convention in all the history of the republic has happened zero times, not a single time. So that's what I'm kind of probing here. Fair enough. Your argument is Relic is starting a very important conversation. You are not shouldering the responsibility for organizing a political movement to do something extremely
right.
First, persuade, inform, start an argument.
Ideas correct? For a free society.
Got it. Okay, last question. I was going to say, do you think 5 years from now you'll have a constitutional amendment? But now that I understand your position, which is you're just at the beginning of the process and you take the burden only of making the argument, the specific political mechanisms are to follow. So just let me ask you this then. Here's my final question. What happens next? You've gotten reviews. I'm sure you're hearing emails. What happens next? Is there a follow-on book? Does this cause get taken up in the academy? Are you working with grad students who are working on this? What's the next step in the argument? Uh-huh. And when does it move from argument to political undertaking?
Well, you know, this is really what Hoover is all about, right? Ideas for a free society. I mean, put the ideas out there, mm-hmm. and the hope is people will listen to them. They'll debate them. They will get out there in the public sphere and influence the way people think about things, right? And people in academia will do that. People in think tanks will do that. And the good ideas will rise to the top. They'll stick around. And they will cause people to begin thinking about policy solutions. So it really is a two-step process. And, you know, as an academic, my view, and I think William's view, mm-hmm. is that our most important job is to get people to understand the nature of the problem, that the failures of American government, the ineffectiveness of American government are not due to polarization and to things that you can just point to today. They go much deeper than that. They go back to the Constitution. We're living with a Constitution that wasn't designed for us, right? It wasn't designed to address the kinds of problems that even Republicans, right, who claim to be conservatives, they're trying to solve these problems too, just in their own ways, through government, right, just differently than Democrats are. Fine, but they don't have a government that allows them to do that effectively. And what we're trying to say is, if you recognize that it's a constitutional problem, then you begin to think about this in a different way, that you need to think about changing the Constitution in some way in order to make American government more effective for Democrats and Republicans, for everybody.
Thank you. Terry Moe, co-author with William Howell of Relic, How our Constitution undermines effective government, thank you.
Thank you.
For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.